Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Courtney Flaherty. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Alec Watson, MD. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Watson discussed the rationale for and key findings from a retrospective analysis examining the ways that oncogene overlap could identify clinically relevant thresholds for MET, KRAS, and HER2 gene copy number gain in non-small cell lung cancer, next steps for this research, and the future implications of these findings. Just to kind of start off our conversation with a little bit of context, could you generally discuss the rationale for conducting this study and any kind of relevant background information that's needed here?
In non-small cell lung cancer, there is a clear divide between cancers that are driven by genetic mechanisms that are identifiable and actionable, which we can variously call driver positive non-small cell lung cancer, or some will call it actional genomic mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer, and those where we can't identify a mechanism that's targetable and chemoimmunotherapy remains the standard of care. There are driver mutations which we are familiar with the implications of. These tend to be either fusions, single nucleotide variations, or insertion deletion mutations in a set of known genes which are oncogenes and drive a pathway of growth and division and metastasis. The implications of amplification or copy number gain in those same genes are not as well understood. You can imagine more copies of a gene could in theory lead to more transcripts, more protein, and if that pathway was then a growth promoting pathway, you'd get potential for oncogenic transformation there. But these events can also happen as part of a cancer evolution and not have implications for oncogenesis or drip driving of a cancer. Cancers naturally gain ploidy. There can be multiple copies of different chromosomes in cancers. Genetic instability is part of the hallmarks of cancer. So identifying a threshold where a copy number gain in an oncogene is of clinical importance and oncogenic importance is not very well defined in the literature. And as such, cancers with these copy number gain in oncogenes are not yet traditionally targetable by the same therapies that we use for traditional driver mutations like fusions, insertion deletions, or point mutations. So in this study in particular, we focused on three genes, HER2, KRAS, and MET. We are developing therapeutic pathways for driver mutations in these genes. MET has approved therapies. HER2 TKIs are new on the block. There are ongoing clinical trials and agents being approved as we speak. KRAS, we have G12C inhibitors, but we don't have inhibitors against the other mutations in KRAS. And all three of these genes, not only do they have evolving therapeutic pathways, they are implicated in on-target and off-target resistance, I should say off-target resistance of other oncogenic targeted pathways. For example, EGFRs are probably in lung cancer our longest targeted and best understood driver mutation pathway. And we know that if you give a cancer with an EGFR traditional mutation, an EGFR inhibitor, over time, they'll either develop on-target resistance, which is less and less common with newer generations of EGFR TKIs, or they can develop off-target resistance, that is, development of another pathway that drives oncogenesis even in the presence of an effective inhibitor. And all three of these genes, MET, HER2, and KRAS, are implicated in that resistance mechanism in various ways. So because of that, we focused on these three genes, and we set out to use a concept called oncogene overlap to better define what is a meaningful copy number gain in these three genes, with the hypothesis that we'd be able to use a better definition of a copy number gain that's clinically significant in future trials of therapeutic agents, either in the primary setting where that's the copy number gain is in and of itself the activating oncogene in a cancer, or in the resistance setting where an existing therapy has now long lost effect and we can identify a copy number gain as a meaningful targetable change in that cancer that would lead to combination therapy addressing that resistance mechanism. Oncogene overlap I'll briefly describe as well. I know that's a lot of background, but oncogene overlap is a concept that says if a cancer only needs one gas pedal, which and in general, the cancer will tend to, at first presentation before therapies, have one dominant mechanism of oncogenesis and a driver mutation. It's rare to find a driver mutation in the primary setting before therapy coexisting with another driver mutation. The idea then would be that if we identified cancers with driver mutations and we looked at the frequency of driver mutations at different tumors, you'd expect a much lower frequency of driver mutations in cancers with a high meaningful copy number gain than in a lower copy number gain where it doesn't have a clinical impact on the cancer. So that's the principle of mutual exclusivity we're leveraging. This concept has been applied before with FISH-based definitions of copy number gain. That's fluorescent in situ hybridization, where you're directly visualizing the cells under a microscope and looking and counting the number of copies of a gene in the cell. But it's less well understood in a not next-generation sequencing concept. Next-generation sequencing is the modern way of defining the genetic profile of a cancer, but it has limits when it comes to defining copy number gain, because you're essentially mashing up lots of tumor, you're counting all the copies of genes that have come out of those cells, and you're trying to decide what's a meaningful increase in the copies of a certain gene compared to all the other genes, much less direct than visualizing a cancer cell under a microscope and counting the number of copies of a gene relative to cells or the centromeres of the chromosomes. So after all of that, the thesis of this paper was that we could use this concept of oncogene overlap and mutual exclusivity to define a copy number gain threshold, the number of copies of a gene via NGS sequencing that would have clinical impacts on the outcomes in that cancer group, and then could then be used to examine what genes co-occur with different amplifications of a high significance, which pathways seem to rely more on amplification as a mechanism of resistance compared to other pathways. That's the concept of the paper. We collaborated with Caris Life Science, who have a large scientific collaboration history and had a 13,000-strong existing cohort of sequenced non-small cell lung cancer tumors with limited annotation, but full genetic profiles on them. And that's what we used as our cohort for this group. I'll just introduce the concept very briefly of a continuous variable versus a discrete variable. Whether or not a tumor carries an EGFR mutation is a yes-no question. And that's nice and simple. You get a result on a NGS report for a clinician, and it says EGFR mutated with a certain mutation that we know is targetable or not. Amplification is much more messy because it's a continuous variable. Amplified can mean two copies of a gene that is just part of genomic instability, or it could mean highly amplified where there's meaningful increase in protein reliance on that pathway and it's driving the cancer. And as of yet, you know, a lot of mutation reports don't give you the level of amplification. Foundation, for example, the level of amplification isn't well reported because the implications of what is a meaningful amplification and not is not well understood. So for a clinician getting a report on a patient's genomic tumor genetic profile, the meaning of an amplification is harder. Is that truly something I should focus on for this patient's care or not? So that's why defining, not just for therapeutic investigations, but for clinicians, knowing the implications of seeing an amplification, for patients seeing their genetics, knowing what amplification means, is this important for me or not, is something we all need to work on as a field. Because as of yet, and this work, you know, is a small step along the pathway, it's by no means definitive, we need to better define the yes-no relationship, or at least what variables we need to consider when interpreting an amplification in a way that properly captures the complexity of what an amplification can mean in a tumor, in the way that a yes-no answer for a mutation can be interpreted by a clinician getting a mutation report. The challenge of a continuous variable compared to a discrete yes-no answer on a mutation is part of the challenge of amplification.
Was there anything else to kind of briefly go over about study design and methodology, particularly in regards to, you know, determining the copy number gain thresholds or criteria to classify the tumors as amplify?
The study design was in collaboration with Caris Life Science, and there was a 13,000 strong cohort that either be sequenced via whole exome sequencing, which looks at the transcribed portions of a gene that eventually make up the protein, or a pre-selected panel of meaningful 592 meaningful genes. So two different platforms that in the end will look at the important genes in a lung cancer. And using that cohort sequence one of those two ways, we defined the DNA-based mutations. They also have an RNA transcriptome, which is used for the fusion mutations that are driver positive. Using that, we set out to define driver mutation pauses, which were done with standard methods of what is a meaningful pathogenic or likely pathogenic driver mutation in lung cancer, and looked at concurrently in those same group of tumors the copy numbers of these three key genes. Copy numbers via NGS, as I mentioned, which is next generation sequencing, isn't as clear and linear as it would be in looking under a microscope. But to look at copy number gain, you look at the copies of a given gene of interest and you calibrate that to an estimate of disomy in the overall sample size. So you have to decide what would be a normal copy number for a gene based on the number of reads, the number of times that sequence of DNA has come up in your next generation sequencing. And then you compare that to your gene of interest. How many times did that gene get sequenced in your meshed up sample? So having done that, we then divided our cohort into those with or without driver mutations and those with or without amplification of one of these three genes of interest, HER2, MET, or KRAS, which you could sort of build as a quadrant then. Either something has a driver mutation or not. Either something has an amplification in your gene of interest or not, which resulted in sort of a four groups for every gene of interest, every copy number gain gene being generated of those total cohort of tumors. And we then looked at the genetic profiles of those tumors in those four groups and then looked at survival implications. I wouldn't say that's the most important part of the study. That's probably more a hypothesis generating.
How did the overlap between those driver-positive oncogenes and the amplified status vary across the different mutations, and what genetic differences were observed?
The results all divide into sort of three main categories. We first were looking at oncogene overlap and trying to examine how the relationship between the number of copies of a gene influenced the driver mutation frequency in that segment of cancers with that number of copies of a gene. So if the copies of gene would be expected to be two for a disomy cell, and as the copy number of that gene of interest increased in a tumor, we found that the frequency of driver mutations decreased for all three. And that was expected because that gets back to the principle of mutual exclusivity. You'd expect as the copy numbers of a gene increased, that is more and more likely to be influencing the growth of a tumor in a driver positive way, acting as a driver mutation in that cancer. And the cancer doesn't need multiple driver mutations in general, although there's a resistance setting, which I'll get to. So you'd expect that as the copy numbers of a gene of interest increased, it would be more likely to have a growth promoting influence, which would make it less likely the cancer needs another pathway driving it alongside in the primary setting, not in the resistance setting. So there's always going to be some overlap because some tumors, which we haven't been able to identify in this cohort, because we don't know whether they're untreated or not, we'd expect that a certain percentage of our cohort will have overlap because that would be a more setting of resistance where cancer had one driver mutation that's acquired a copy number gain, for example. But we would expect overall in the whole cohort a decrease in the frequency of coexisting driver mutations as the copy number for each of these three genes increased. And we did find that. We divided it between all driver mutations, so considering every identified mutation that can drive a lung cancer, and looked at that frequency versus the frequency of the copy number gain in the x-axis. And then we also looked at that same plot, but ignoring same gene mutations and copy number gain. That means we excluded, for example, KRAS mutations if we're looking at KRAS copy number gain. And that's important because the implications of a already mutated gene being amplified are very different than a different driver pathway coexisting with amplified wild type KRAS. Dividing those plots, same with all driver mutations and ignoring same gene coexisting amplification and driver mutations, we saw that as copy number gain increased, the frequency of driver mutations decreased. For MET, that started at a lower copy number gain than for HER2 or KRAS. And based on our principle of mutual exclusivity, you might say, does that imply that MET at a lower gene copy number can influence a cancer, whereas the other copy number gains don't seem to be clinically important because they're coexisting with other driver mutations until they get to a much higher threshold? It's possible. That would need more basic science, but hypothesis generating in this context. We did therefore, as a headline, prove that the principle of oncogene overlap is adequately applied to a NGS-based tissue sampling using this method of decreasing frequency and increasing copy number gain. And we then defined a threshold, what we called meaningfully amplified, for each of these three genes. For MET, it was simplest because the frequency of coexisting driver mutations plateaued, meaning that past a certain threshold, the cancer didn't seem to want or need more MET. At least that didn't further decrease the frequency of coexisting mutations. And that's a much easier line to draw. For HER2 and KRAS, the frequency continued to decrease to the highest threshold we could examine in our sample. So we set it at the highest meaningful copy number gain because it seemed like more copies still led to further decrease in the frequency of coexisting driver mutations. This is, again, more of a hypothesis generating. We don't have good annotation to look at what treatments these cancers have received before, which is a big limit to our data set. But we would put that first part of the results to say, using NGS and oncogene overlap, we can define a threshold that isn't just based on us picking a number of what copy number gain we think is clinically meaningful for a cancer, but based on a biological mutual exclusivity. This copy number gain seems to define a subgroup of meaningfully amplified HER2, KRAS, MET amplified cancers that then could be studied in targeted therapy trials, hopefully enriching most for cancers that would respond to inhibition of that pathway, because that pathway is driving the cancer. That's oncogene overlap in a nutshell. So having defined a threshold we would use for the rest of the investigation of what we called a copy number that was meaningfully amplified for KRAS and HER2, that turned out to be a copy of 6, copy number gain of 6, whereas in MET, 4 or more led to a plateau in our frequency. So we used a copy number gain threshold of 4 going forward to what we called MET amplified. Using that, our next goal was to look at what specific driver mutations coexisted with highly amplified MET, KRAS, or HER2, because you'd guess that overall we've selected a population that has lower frequency of driver mutations, and that's that principle of mutual exclusivity. But there might be some mutations that are more likely to coexist with an amplified gene, and that's because we know that in acquired resistance to therapies, certain gene pathways are more synergistic for cancer growth. For example, EGFR's reliance on MET as a resistance pathway is pretty well defined. And of the off-target resistance, MET is frequently one that we combine a MET agent with an EGFR agent if we identify MET amplification or MET mutation as a mechanism of resistance. And we can see objective response rates in tumors that didn't respond to a EGFR TKI anymore, responding to the addition of a MET-directed therapy. So we were seeing which copy number gain genes coexisted with driver mutations that were, more traditionally defined. And what we found was for the MET group in particular, for all three genes as a headline, there was frequent co-amplification and mutation. So we saw same gene alterations at an increased frequency than would be expected. And this has been previously defined as a phenomenon, but not as generalized and not quantified in the way that this NGS investigation allows us to, because NGS allows us to see in the same cohort simultaneously mutations and copy number gain in a way that, fish-based amplification is harder to directly go from a microscope to the genetic sequencing that was done by more traditional methods. And we found that, for example, MET amplification was more likely to occur with MET mutation, certainly than other driver mutations. And in fact, for MET in particular, it was more likely that the high-level amplification occurred with a MET mutation than without. The idea then would be that if you have a mutated gene, for some mutated genes, that cancer is already reliant on that pathway, perhaps further emphasis on that pathway is able to overcome methods of tumor suppression or even targeted therapy, but we don't have that data for what these cancers were exposed to. But we saw for all three genes, there seemed to be a same pathway mutation and amplification in process. For MET in particular, we did also get a signal that for MET EGFR mutations were more likely to occur with MET amplified than the other amplified tumors, and BRAF. EGFR is pretty well defined. We know, as I mentioned, that MET is a pathway of resistance in EGFR mutated cancers, but BRAF is less well defined. BRAF TKIs exist in lung cancer and they're approved and used, but the resistance mechanisms to BRAF inhibition or what pathways are synergistic with BRAF left less well understood. So we'd, again, in the future, it'd be nice to see in a better annotated data set whether BRAF-treated cancers are these ones that are popping up with more MET amplification. So this is preliminary. The limit of our investigation in this way is that these highly amplified tumors are very rare events. Even with 13,000 tumors in our cohort, less than 1%, 1% or less of them were highly amplified for HER2, KRAS, or MET, which means that if you then subdivide that 1% into the different mutation subgroups, you are starting to get limited for power. You know, with this as a large cohort and perhaps focusing on a predefined selection for amplification in the future might allow better understanding of that landscape. And the big limit to our coexisting mutations analysis is we do not know which treated tumors with PKIs and which weren't, which means that all the guesses of what is a primary resistance mechanism and a secondary resistance mechanism is all speculative. As I mentioned off the top, the whole principle of oncogene overlap means it's rare to see primary resistance with two active oncogenic pathways in the same tumor, but it rarely occurs. More common is the acquisition of a second pathway in the setting of resistance to targeting of a pathway, but we aren't able to separate which tumors are treated and which tumors aren't in our analysis, which limits our ability to really understand the implications of the coexisting genes that we're identifying. There was a hypothesis-generating survival analysis we added on at the end. For our tumors, we had access to basic insurance claim data, which we could track as the first submitted whenever Caris had a tumor submitted to them for sequencing. We would then be able to track insurance claims for those tumors, patients, until their last claim, at which point, based on, although there's some confounders in what a last claim means, it would be a surrogate for survival, which means we could track in a general way from the time a tumor was submitted until the patient was no longer able to be active on cancer therapies for whatever reason. And because we focused on advanced tumors in this cohort, the presumption would be that that's a surrogate of overall survival. We were then able to look at copy number thresholds impact on survival, and for each gene, the higher copy numbers of each genes led to a higher hazard ratio per death, so lower survival association. And when divided by each gene, so amplified for HER2, KRAS, or MET, there seemed to be negative implications for HER2 and MET. With or without driver mutations, it seemed to have a negative prognostic association. For KRAS, that association was present when KRAS amplification coexisted with another driver mutation, but not without. All speculative. Again, we do not have treatment data for these tumors. And one could suspect that if amplifications are acquired over time, perhaps all we're doing is saying highly amplified tumors are further along in their treatment course, ergo they're going to have lower survival from sequencing until the last claim. But if we're looking for other explanations for why a negative survival association exists, we know that amplification of these genes is not yet targetable in general. MET amplification, there are some small cohorts that say that applying a TKI has effect on MET amplified tumors. There's a response rate, and that response rate seems to track with higher levels of copy number gain, but that's not understood for KRAS or for HER2. So it's a driver mechanism without an approved therapy right now. There's also implication, you know, most of these tumors may be acquiring resistance with amplification, and that would therefore also associate with lower survival because that tumor is further on its treatment course because it's a resistant tumor that's had a first-line therapy or two. And there's also, one would guess, that maybe amplifications are more likely to be acquired in certain tumors that have more aggressive phenotypes like genomic instability, and that would be speculative. But either way, this sort of furthers the exponent, which has been observed elsewhere, that higher amplification levels seem to associate with lower survival. So this would be a group we'd want to see better therapies investigated for, hopefully approved for, to help with these amplified cohorts in particular, because these tumors are not doing as well, whether that's in a resistant setting or in a primary setting, acknowledging the confounders in our analysis.
What are some of the other sort of next steps? I know prospective studies were sort of mentioned in the paper that might be needed or maybe are already planned to further validate the benefits and applicability of the results.
This is a large cohort, which has defined oncogene overlap as a a potential method to better set our threshold for what is an amplified tumor and what is not. We'd love to see those amplified thresholds taken forward in therapeutic investigations, particularly for targeted therapies against the pathways that are amplified. We're hoping that this higher threshold defined with oncogene overlap allows a judicious application of a threshold, which defines a cancer that might respond to TKIs versus those that might not, in a way that an arbitrary set threshold may not as well. We obviously want to be set a threshold that's high enough that we're not including tumors that are just using amplification that's along for the ride. It's a passenger mutation. It's not truly a driving pathway. But you also don't want to set it too low where we're ignoring tumors where a therapy might be effective and we're not applying it to that group. So prospective investigations, now that HER2 TKIs are approved, that's a particular therapeutic gap where we need to understand how amplified HER2 amplified tumors respond to the TKIs, which are just coming on the market or finishing early phase clinical trials with promising results. For KRAS, we're limited by the agents we have. We have KRAS G12C inhibitors. There isn't data around that I'm aware of for the response of tumors that are KRAS G12C amplified, but our investigation included all KRAS agents in general. The KRAS therapeutic space needs further therapeutic investigations and optimization beyond just amplified tumors. But for MET and HER2, there are agents that are approved. We'd love to see prospective investigations with approved agents in these amplified groups we've defined. The annotations, as I mentioned, are a big limit of our work. It would be nice to see future investigations with better annotated data sets be able to dig into the implications of coexisting amplification and mutations, if that's truly a mechanism of resistance, for example, in BRAF tumors relying on MET amplification as a resistance mechanism, that would need better annotation than we have available to us for this investigation. And the survival implications will come with better annotation as well, understanding what's a primary mechanism and what's a secondary. So yeah, hopefully these thresholds and the principle of oncogene overlap will help future clinical trials of targeted agents in the spaces of HER2 amplification, MET amplification, perhaps in the future KRAS amplification. And better annotated data sets will define the associations we've identified in the context of the true treatment history of those tumors.
What is your sort of overall message you want to convey about the ultimate significance and, I guess, current implications?
This is exploratory work that's helping build on prior work in the field of amplification and defining what is a meaningful copy number gain. The heterogeneity in the field makes comparing results very difficult because everyone is defining copy number gain a different way, and everyone is defining what threshold defines copy number gain within each mutation group a different way. So I'm hoping this continues to build the field towards a common understanding of what is an amplified tumor that then could be taken into therapeutic investigations and allow us to better understand truly how effective therapies are in amplified groups. And for patients who have these amplified tumors, continue to build better therapies that are able to truly target the genetics of their cancer, which we can see, but we can't yet meaningfully leverage to improve outcomes in these tumors. You have these results available to us now in tumor reports, and they're getting, it's great that we have so much more information than we did 10 years ago coming into clinicians. We understand lung cancer at a level that, you know, all the different diseases that make up non-small cell lung cancer in a way we didn't before. But we still have ways to go in really leveraging all the information that now provided to us, because if we have information without interpretation, then it's noise. Thanks to all the other authors. Obviously, I was just one author on the paper. Thanks to Karis for the collaboration, the different input that we had on the paper, and the patients whose samples are helping us in a study to better understand their tumors and hopefully improve care.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Live on Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc Live is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at Onc Live. On Facebook, like us at Onc Live and follow our Onc Live page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Onc Live on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave on Air.